Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. And this is the Overton window at work. The idea coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton describes the range of ideas that are politically possible at any one time. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues go from impossible to plausible to policy and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, there was a move for investors to get businesses to behave in more ethical ways by mandating that they use appropriate business practices with regards to the environment, social, and governance issues. And in practice, this meant that businesses just had to adopt a bunch of progressive causes. But Richard Morrison and John Mozena argue in a recent paper that if investors took ESG seriously, it would mean that they stop asking for subsidies and other favors from the government. And so I'm going to talk with him today. Richard is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and host of the Free the Economy podcast, which I recommend to listeners. And John is the president of the Center for Economic Accountability. Richard and John, welcome.
Thank you.
What's your paper about?
John?
Basically, the paper says pretty much what you said, that investors, corporate governance advocates, elected officials, and all the other stakeholders out there on this topic ought to view corporate welfare. Specifically, what we look at is the practice of awarding economic development subsidies, incentives, targeted economic development incentives to corporations. Basically, when companies go to government, state and local government, or even the federal government, and ask for a special deal in order to, quote, create jobs, unquote. That's obviously a topic that you personally and the Mackinac Center in general have been talking about for decades at this point. That's the focus of the
organization. First thing I ever wrote about in the public policy arena, by the way, back in 2002.
It's an oldie but a goodie. And that's what the organization I lead, the Center for Economic Accountability, does. It's a topic that the Competitive Enterprise Institute has long been vocal about. And we make the point that this is, you know, that going out there asking for a bunch of money to do things that the research shows very clearly just don't return benefits to the communities that are paying for them, to the taxpayers who are paying for them. You just simply cannot in any way call that ethical corporate governance. And people who do believe that companies have a responsibility to act ethically in the world, to do business ethically, to do good by the communities in which they do business, this is a topic they ought to be looking at. And we also sort of make the follow-on point that if companies that have all made sort of, as you said, in recent years, all these statements about, we have an ESG component or division, or this is something we take seriously or whatever, if they don't want to keep getting dragged into the same culture war stuff that they've been sort of dragged into over the past couple of years, that making sort of a opposition to corporate welfare and a promise not to do it part of their ESG governance, it's a topic that really doesn't have partisan political baggage, and it's one that they can get involved in without having to pick a lot of those fights.
All right, so let me challenge you on this, because this is the old argument that these business subsidies do not serve a public purpose, and they serve someone's private interest. Well, I mean, economic growth is a public benefit, right? Aren't these companies bringing jobs? Are they going to be embedded into the normal business networks? It's going to increase prosperity for the places where they locate, and therefore it is an appropriate thing for them to ask for money, and it is an appropriate thing for governments to hand that out. So why is that a bad thing?
Well, that's the idea, but that's not the way things actually work. The Mackinac Center's own research showed that sure, there was job creation in Michigan through subsidy programs, but it came at the cost of, I don't remember the exact number, it was on the order of $600,000 per job per year. Like, that in no way is having taxpayers pay $600,000 a year to create a single job at your company ethical corporate governance. These programs do not, in fact, deliver what they say on the label. That they don't deliver economic growth. Places that do more of them aren't any better off than places that don't do as many of them. The purpose of them is less into the real world to create jobs and more to make voters believe that politicians are responsible for creating jobs. That's part of why we got it in this, and this is why we're starting to push this, is that for so long, the efforts at reforming these programs, trying to cut back on or even potentially eliminate corporate welfare, have really focused on sort of the supply side of the equation, at trying to convince elected officials and bureaucrats and other government agencies not to hand them out. We got to talking and thought, well, maybe there's something we could do to try to reduce the demand, try to create disincentives, or at least minimize the incentives for businesses to be asking for these subsidies. Can we come at it the other direction? And that's where Richard's expertise lies, in what levers exist to get companies to try to behave in a way that we want them to behave.
When it comes to the argument that, isn't this a reasonable public policy? Because after all, it does create jobs and it does create economic activity. You know, I think at best, I mean, sometimes these simply fail entirely, right? Sometimes there are promises made and companies simply don't build plants, don't hire people, and nothing goes forward. But even when
research suggests for major deals, they only deliver 9% of the jobs that are promised. So it should be an expectation that companies fail to deliver on those expectations. But broader point is that, do they actually deliver the broad-based economic growth? The answer to that is clearly no, because economists have looked at, use clever methods to isolate the economic effects of these programs. Sometimes they find positive effects. My job might be easier if they didn't. Most of the time they do find negative effects, but they never find large effects. That is, if you're expecting these things to deliver broad-based economic growth, it's just not going to happen. Sorry, I just wanted to get that rant in.
Yes, that's excellent. So sometimes this stuff doesn't happen in the first place, but when there are, bricks piled on bricks and there are visual stuff happening, right? We see plants being built. It is, at best, moving money around rather than sort of creating new wealth, right? So people who are in the wonky world of free market economics will probably be familiar with the phrase from Frederick Bastiat and Henry Hazlitt, that in order to understand the impact of an economic program, you need to see the seen and see the unseen, right? You need to see the big obvious consequences, but also the real but less obvious consequences to everyone in the equation. And so when you take that money out of taxpayers' pockets and you give it to a company, you can create some economic activity on the other side of the ledger, but it's usually a net negative. It's less than would have been if that money could have been deployed by the people to whom it actually belongs. And so it's sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul, usually with the government taking a slice out of there on top of it. So it's not that the economic development programs that are being funded and incentivized don't do anything, but you're basically, buying a $75,000 job for $600,000 in subsidies, as John said, which again is not a smart use of anyone's money.
Yeah, and Richard's point about the unseen, one of the things that makes this sort of topical, makes this something that an argument that we can make fairly forcefully now that might have been more difficult to make even just a few years ago, is that there's been a whole bunch of research driven in part by some wonky things like a federal government accounting board standards that made governments actually report how much money they were losing in revenue. So finally, over the past decade or so, there's actually been some numbers for researchers to work with. But that there's been a flowering of research over the past decade or so that really does start shining some light on things that were previously unseen. So we talk in our paper about some of the research from researchers at major universities looking at this stuff. Things like places that do more subsidies see lower business startup rates and lower rates of successful entrepreneurship, which sort of makes sense at a gut level if you think about it. If you're getting a bunch of money to the big incumbent businesses in a region, that makes it that much harder to be a small business startup entrepreneur. Decreases economic freedom and the long-term fiscal health of local governments, which again makes sense when you've got, this is all central economic planning. You know, I joke that they call them economic development agencies, because the name Soviets was trademarked, that this is all, you know, the belief that the government is going to do a better job at planning the economy than the free market will. And that's, it's sort of, you're taking the opposite side of the North versus South Vietnam, East versus West Germany, North versus South Korea divide that we've seen over the, we ran that test in the real world over the past century. And even things like there's some research out of, I believe, the Southern Methodist University that found actually decreased innovation measured by the number of patents filed in a region in places that do more economic development subsidies. And I asked one of the researchers, you know, did you study the mechanism for why this happens? He said, no, we just sort of, you know, that's maybe next. And I said, well, do you have a gut feel for why that is, even if you didn't study it? And he's like, yeah, it's cheaper to hire lobbyists than scientists. So there's all sorts of, you know, over and over.
There are some pretty expensive lobbyists out there.
Yeah, there's that too. But
there are expensive scientists too.
Yeah. So over and over again, what we see is these second and third order effects where sort of, you know, any good free market economist will tell you that the more you sort of poke at the economy, the more bad things will happen. And it's not just dollars and cents. It's not just tax revenues. There are larger impacts, negative impacts that happen to an economy when you start trying to make it run the way you think it ought to be running rather than the way the market is moving it.
So we can talk for a lot about the ineffectiveness of selective business subsidies. Guys, check out our work. We've got that. If you're unconvinced about this, we go through all the arguments and the drivers for it. Check out their paper, which lays it out pretty well. But what you're doing is to say, look, there are these investors that care about governance issues. And if they care about this, they should really care about whether the companies that they're investing in are asking for subsidies and other favors from the government. So you've made the argument, but you really have to convince not the public, but these investors who care. How are you doing that?
Right. So, you know, part of the inspiration for this is that there's already this kind of widely recognized, well-built out kind of ecosystem of lobbying companies to conform to certain, moral, ethical, and ideological precepts. So in, the past, decade or so, that's largely been called, ESG, environmental, social, and governance. And theoretically, that was sort of a neutral construct for saying we want companies to do good things. But the vast majority of the people who were involved in that movement were sort of left-wing, sort of progressive left kind of people, which is fine. You're allowed to be a progressive left person. But
it's okay to have opinions.
Because the vast majority of those people were from that perspective, most of those topics were left-wing policy priorities that companies were being pressured to accede to. And so people who were maybe in the center or, the right side of the political spectrum kind of soured on that idea, saying, oh, well, this whole ESG corporate governance, corporate ethics thing out there, that's a left-wing thing. We don't want to have anything to do with that. Well, there's no reason why it has to be. And I, personally, I think that kind of disciplining companies not to soak the taxpayers is a whole spectrum kind of thing, which is that anyone can get behind it. Plenty of people who are sort of left-wing people are very skeptical of corporate power, right? And that's the last thing they would want is their taxpayer money going to subsidize.
It's one of the things that Marxists and libertarians agree on.
Yeah. And so... But I think this is an example. It's not the right wing version. I think it's the side of everyone version on this, on this issue. So there are, lots of ways of doing this, like this interview we're doing right now, this podcast, writing letters to, the sort of the open public letter to a CEO and to shareholders. There's a much more kind of deep dive version, which is creating, if you were the shareholder of a company, and lots of kind of activists and advocacy organizations have small stakes in companies just so they can have the opportunity to do this, right? They can put forward a shareholder proposal, and then you can do direct shareholder engagement, which is you call or email the investor relations office at a corporation, and they can sit down and talk with you if you have a serious concern. And a lot of companies, even very big companies, are more responsive to that if they, you know, assured you that you have a serious point to make, are more responsive to that than a lot of people probably imagine, because there actually aren't that many people out there doing that. And so some friends of ours in the free market movement have been doing that, a few of them for many years, more of them for the past few years, to raise their concerns and push back on some of, again, we go back to the ESG priorities, bringing corporate governance back sort of in the direction that they think is more reasonable. So there are a lot of ways to do that. And then, you know, other activist organizations, they put out full, again, so studies and reports like this, where they'll say, like, here's the, you know, the 10 worst companies that are doing this bad behavior, and try and, you know, shame them in the public square. And when, you know, the people who work for that company, their communications and media people, they see their name popping up in negative reports in media, often they get in touch with you.
Mm-hmm. So what I like about the strategy is that it's affecting one of the drivers for the policy. So on the Overton window for this issue, despite all the work that we've done, politicians love jobs. They want their name in print to show that they're doing something about jobs, and they're willing to write $100 million checks in order to get those headlines, regardless of effectiveness, regardless of fairness, regardless of basic constitutional principles. It's just that's the issue, that's the primary political driver for these things. But one of the things that I think people don't recognize is that one of the reasons why politicians write these $100 million checks is because companies ask for them. And if the company thought that it was possible for the lawmakers to say no, they probably wouldn't ask. But it's the making the request directly to elected officials that drives a lot of the favoritism that goes on in state and local governments and at the federal government level as well. And so you're like, well, why don't we convince businesses to not ask? That would do it. You wouldn't have to convince hundreds of millions of people that these business subsidies are ineffective, unfair, and inappropriate. You just you win if you get companies to stop asking. That's really clever. So I just wanted to say that.
I think that there's an example of a case where maybe this happened on its own without people like me and John pushing, and that's the Amazon HQ2 process. So a lot of people remember from a few years ago, it's probably several years ago when it very first started, Amazon was looking for sort of a second subsidiary headquarters for its company, extremely large company, sort of prestigious potential facility for any city to have. And so they had this process where cities, states, counties were sending in proposals, saying, well, you know, if we bring a new big Amazon facility to your city, what are you going to give us? And so they were economic development people working overtime, putting together these huge, complex, detailed proposals to send to Amazon, saying, please, please come to our city. Here's the laundry list of all the goodies we're going to give you if you agree to come set up in our backyard. And a lot of them were, you know, as they were sort of initially rolled out, some of these proposals were, you know, talked about in public, and they were doing, local officials were doing interviews on them. They appeared to be like really excessive giveaways, right? All sorts of, you know, tax abatements and subsidies. And
and there's reason for that. It's a big company. You can argue that in addition to the jobs, and it was a massive project, at least that it was pitched, that it has, of course, not delivered on those job expectations in the years since, but which you should expect. But it's also saying, oh, this is the company of the future, and mm-hmm. if we land this, there's extra political benefits.
Right. So Amazon was like, in particular, kind of considered to be an A-list target. But as, you know, reporting on these proposals came out, there was a real public backlash where people, again, I think across the political spectrum, said, this is too much. This is excessive. This is sort of like mortgaging the future of your city or county for jobs that may or may not show up. And so even though Amazon is an extremely popular company, very popular with customers, if you look at some of these, some of the research has been done by like brand marketing consultants. It's like, what companies do Americans love? Amazon is way, way up at the top. It's a huge, stratospherically high approval rating as far as customers go. But when it came to sort of the political economy, the sort of politics of this, a lot of people who were normally, you know, Amazon customers said, this feels wrong. This is way too much of a giveaway. Taxpayers are being soaked or potentially in all of these areas if they, you know, if they win the contract. So And I think the Amazon people and some other big companies, because this was such a high profile issue, kind of maybe learned their lesson, hopefully to an extent, that even if they have a process like this where they're siting a new facility, even if they can get millions of dollars of promise of subsidies, maybe the negative PR involved in the process as a whole is not worth it for them.
Yeah, and that gets to the point you were making, James, earlier about the idea that politicians do this because they at the end of the day, they feel like they benefit at the ballot box. And the research shows that, yes, in fact, they do. There was some really good research by our mutual friend, Nathan Jensen, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, as well as a colleague, Eddie Molesky, at Duke University, that found that a swing state governor running for re-election who can take credit for, quote, winning, unquote, 1,000 manufacturing jobs through a subsidy program doesn't really affect the partisan voters on either side, but in the middle, among the independent voters who often make or lose, win or lose elections for you, that it could move independent voter intent by as much as 9 points. You shift 9% of independent voters, you're going to win a lot of elections. But those same researchers then went back and reran the question and sort of said, well, this now means that that money for that subsidy is no longer going to be available for other governmental purposes or to not be taken from taxpayers in the first place. And when they reran the question, sort of making the cost side of the cost benefit argument, as well as just the benefit side, which is usually all we hear from the politicians and the companies and the economic development bureaucrats, the voter intent went away. It didn't make people oppose the deal, but it didn't change the way they voted. It didn't change the way they felt about the elected officials. And so that's part of what that's sort of a subsidiary second order effect that we're trying for here, in that part of what we're trying to do is make people just think that these deals are bad and they're not something that businesses should be doing. And by, corollary to that is that's not something that politicians should be doing. And we're seeing some of that just sort of happen naturally, in Michigan, where first the Republican Party, but I think in general, there's been this political backlash, and the House Republicans flipped partisan control of the House in the last election, in part due to a fairly explicit anti-corporate welfare platform after a string of really high profile failed deals elsewhere in the country. When you have this going out there and when people start viewing these programs as bad, thanks in part to things like the really egregious giveaways contained in some of the Amazon HQ2 proposals, like it was New Rochelle, New York, that offered a island with a former U.S. Army base on it in Long Island Sound. It was sort of like a whole Dr. Evil vibe that they were promising Jeff Bezos there. The more that people start seeing this stuff as bad, the less political value there is to it, which means that the less the politicians are going to be willing to do some of that stuff. And if you make this an ESG issue and the first couple of companies start going out there and then talking actively about subsidies are bad, that's why we don't do them, then all of a sudden we have a bunch of corporate interests on our side against these deals in a way we really don't have now, other than a very few companies here and there. And reducing these sort of broad business communities' desire to push these things is great, wonderful, and the best thing since sliced bread is going to make a difference in how beneficial they are to politicians. And hopefully that means a lot fewer of them get made.
So I love the theory. The question is about implementation. So there's a couple of leverage points that you got, or at least a couple of people who would make a big difference on getting companies to adopt these practices. And that's the people who do ESG ratings of companies and the people who are ESG investors. They care about this issue, then some businesses can change how they behave. Have you heard from them?
Well, I think there's a lot of people who have gotten into the sort of lobbying companies on management practices just in the past few years. Like I said, a lot of the people who've been doing it for much longer are left of center advocates. And even though we certainly expect those two people there to be allies because of the sort of, egalitarian angle with this. But again, the more center right people have been,
also that, Wayne.
ESG is a bad practice. You shouldn't ask for this. You should just ask for profit from companies.
Absolutely. But even among the people who aren't just the sort of Milton Friedman profit only people, there's plenty of people who would be willing to fold this into their list of things they want companies to do or not to do. You know, as yet, I have not sat down with Larry Fink at BlackRock to make this a short list of BlackRock's demands of the companies that they hold. And they're the biggest asset manager, so they're usually, their name is invoked as the number one big kahuna when it comes to pressuring companies to do or not do things. But if Larry Fink's next investor letter that rolls out, you know, is the since he's out every year, next January or February, has this as a top issue, we will count that as a win. But like I said, there's already at least this sort of structure here where all of the big public companies have some sort of team working on this already, and it would be we're not sort of adding companies to reinvent the wheel here, but add this on their list of sort of corporate responsible goals, right? And sort of like things they sign on and pledge to do or not to do. And the other angle, which is so they've got sort of conventional ESG topics, which is like, here's our climate goal and here's our sort of diversity goal and things like that. But they also have often international kind of legal compliance issues with what is in the US is called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which means a US company, you can't go to a developing country with a corrupt government and pay them bribes to get a contract. That should be illegal in that other country, but it's illegal even here in the United States explicitly. And so the biggest and usually the biggest internationally operating public companies that are that have the most influence. So all of those big companies that operate internationally have some place in their annual report where they talk about the fact that they comply with foreign corrupt practices, that they don't do corrupt stuff overseas, they don't bribe officials, they don't take corrupt benefits from officials overseas. And I think that there's a clear analog to that here in the United States with these targeted incentive deals that they are, taxpayer giveaways for one specific company. That's the big, maybe the most salient aspect about this. And so they can take their compliance with not taking taxpayer handouts and fool that into or be informed by the stuff they do to comply legally overseas. And I think there's a direct analog there that is part of what these big companies are already doing.
Mm-hmm. And the answer, this is the more tactical answer to your question, James, is that to some extent, this is a marathon, not a sprint, and we're in the fairly early stages of it. So we've been sort of having discussions with both directly with some folks as well as more generally. I know Richard was having some discussions with groups of people who were involved in the management of state pension plans, who have I think the single biggest institutional investor in the world is CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System. These state government pension plans have got somewhat into ESG investing in many cases and got their fingers burned a little bit in some cases. So there's some discussions to be had there. Part of our plan moving forward is to be doing sort of more of this stuff publicly. But at this point, it's very much sort of, again, as you said, we have to sort of introduce them to the concept. And this has also been the past few months. It's been a time of a little bit of a economic upheaval and whatnot. So getting folks' attention right now for something that isn't immediate top of mind has been a little bit fun, but it has been happening. And I think, and I suspect Richard would agree with me, that when we do present this to folks who are in positions of this sort of stuff, the response that I at least have been getting anecdotally seems to be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I hadn't really thought of that. Oh yeah, of course. Sort of like, yeah, that this is very obviously, it is an issue of corporate governance. And it is an issue of sort of what we used to call corporate social responsibility in a very clear and direct way. I mean, it's about a business doing something businessy for business reasons, in a way that a lot of sort of ESG asks or concerns or demands in recent years are maybe sort of tangential. You know, does Nike need a responsible forestry practices, you know, et cetera. You know, there's all sorts of examples of companies asked to go outside their lanes or to take opinions on issues that just really don't affect them any more than they do anybody else in the world. That sort of gave a lot of the ESG components a bad rap. Whereas this is very much just like, hey, you're doing harmful stuff here, company, by dragging resources out of the communities you do business in for no good reason. Stop doing that, or we will say that you are a company that is managed poorly. And that's a fairly easy explanation to make and a fairly simple ask to make.
So what are our chances that this is going to be practice?
Well, there's, you know, the two parts here. There's what we're asking government officials to do and not to do. No, we're asking companies to do and not to do. You know, I think we have, for reasons John just said, I think we have a good opportunity with a lot of these companies because as the paper points out, most companies, the vast majority of companies, aren't recipients of these deals. We're not in an equilibrium where 90% of companies are paid off to move to a new location. A relatively small percentage of companies take these sort of targeted deals. And again, just to be clear, we're not objecting to politicians making it easier to do business in their state in general, right? So if you want to, say, cut the corporate tax rate or, lighten some regulations on all the businesses operating in your state, that's probably a fantastic thing to do for economic development. What we're saying is that you shouldn't give a special deal to one specific company that's sort of a bespoke off the books direct agreement. So it's something that I think it'll be easy for a lot of companies to say yes to not taking these deals because most of them aren't benefiting in the first place. Second, big companies rarely make location decisions for these subsidies alone. There's a big long list of things that have to do with, you know, transportation, local schools, you know, proximity to healthcare, all sorts of things like that that make the difference when they are going to create a new facility, especially if it's going to create or attract a lot of jobs. They're worried about the environment that those people or employees are going to live in. And also because it's just something that's easily folded into what they're doing already, like I said, with ESG stuff and international compliance for not being corrupt. On the sort of public policy side, I think pointing out some of the scandals, and there definitely have been scandals with these economic development funds, where there are either politicians or kind of, you know, civil servant state and county employees who have gone to prison, right, because of some of these kind of slush funds have been so poorly administered. But I think also on the sort of public policy side, on the state government, the rules state government has for itself, one of the maybe easiest asks, and the one that I personally have gotten the most enthusiastic response in, is getting rid of what a lot of states have, which is this secrecy privacy when it comes to these deals. So when a big company is in negotiation with like a state economic development entity, and even when there's millions of dollars of future taxpayer money in play, the state government will say, oh, well, you can't see the deals. You can't see the details. You can't see the sort of, in effect, contract we're signing because that's private. That's business secrets, or that's, you know, the company is a potential taxpayer, and so we can't reveal taxpayer information. So the deal is secret. You can't, if you have a state freedom of information law, doesn't apply. If we have a meeting to discuss it, state open meeting and sunshine laws do not apply. It's a complete secret, right? And a lot of people, especially when, you know, again, it's their taxpayer money potentially being spent. A lot of people in a lot of states look at that and say, that's crazy. Why? How is this? How can you keep this secret? But that's the law in some places. And getting a state legislature, for example, to either change that law or maybe, you know, the softer version, which is, you know, having state economic boards waive their ability to keep it secret, or getting companies to waive that secrecy, I think is the first step. But, you know, like we said, we always say about government operations, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And the more secret it is, the more it's sort of, you know, my religious friends would say it's a temptation to sit, right? It won't necessarily result in a grosser, more unfair deal, but it's certainly a temptation if there's no one looking over your shoulder when it's being written.
So listeners, check out Richard's work at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Check out John's work at the Center for Economic Accountability. Make sure to check out the Free the Economy podcast. And good, Richard and John, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.